Welcome to episode 67 of the Fredcast Cycling Podcast for the week of April the 9th, 2007. My name is David, and I'm a Fred. In this week's episode of the Fredcast, Jan Ulrich's blood is found in the Puerto samples, I've got Pro Tour racing news, the Tour of Utah gets postponed, Nike and Trek part company, and the Floyd Fairness Fund takes its case to YouTube. Following the news, an extended interview with John Winston from the Bikescape podcast all about last week's events at the Critical Mass in San Francisco. So sit back, relax, and if you're riding your bike, hammer just a little bit harder, because here comes the Fredcast. This week's episode of the Fredcast is sponsored by Cambria Bicycle Outfitter, your online source for the best in cycling products. Don't forget to check the links at thefredcast.com to find out this week's Fred's Picks of the Week, as well as to get your promo code for free shipping off your next order from Cambria Bike. Cambria Bicycle Outfitters, they outfit the world. Well, welcome back to another episode of the Fredcast. It's great to be back with you with a lot of news and an amazing interview at the end of the show. But first up, the top of the news and what prompted the interview that you'll hear a little bit later was an incident that occurred at the Critical Mass ride at the end of March in San Francisco, California. Now, if you're not familiar with Critical Mass, this is an event that's been going on for about 15 years now. And in San Francisco, it happens on the last Friday of every month, although you can find Critical Masses literally all over the world. Google it, and I guarantee you'll find one in your area. Now, Critical Mass is a time when cyclists literally take over the streets of a city, and it is a chance for bicycles to dominate the streets when, under most normal circumstances, cars dominate the streets. For the most part, these are peaceful events, just a chance for people to get out on their bikes and ride on the streets. Like any event or any group of large people, there's always the possibility that there may be a couple of troublemakers in the midst, and unfortunately, that has happened with Critical Mass in the past. But this past Friday, there was yet another high-profile incident that occurred. And basically, what I can piece together from the news stories, and there really are two sides to this story. There is the story from the motorist and also the story from the cyclist. But basically, what I can piece together is that the Critical Mass had ended, and there was a group of cyclists who were really at the tail end of the ride. And as they were riding past this one intersection, of course, there were also some police there to make sure that the motorists stayed where they needed to stay and the cyclists stayed where they needed to stay. And according to the witnesses, the police allegedly waved a minivan through this intersection. And now this is where the stories diverge. One story says that the minivan did nothing and was really literally attacked by the cyclist simply for the fact that it had driven into the area where the Critical Mass was happening. Now, the cyclists say that the driver of the minivan, a mom, clipped one of the cyclists, threw him from his bike, and then rode over his bike and then started driving away. Now, that's essentially a hit and run. And so the cyclist caught up to the minivan and surrounded it, intending to hold it until police arrived. And all reports say that it was a cyclist that called 911 to report this hit and run. And actually, that call, at least according to the cyclist, occurred before the mom in the minivan called 911 because she feared for her and her family's safety. Now, the backstory is that the mom and dad and two daughters and three friends of one of the daughters had come into San Francisco. They're not San Francisco City residents. They had come into the city to celebrate the birthday of one of the daughters. And that when the cyclists surrounded the car, they were pretty scared because, at least according to the driver, the cyclists were banging on the windows and scratching the paint and climbing up on the roof of the car. Now, according to the cyclist, that didn't happen. But what they both agree on is that one of the cyclists picked up his or her bike and hurled it through the back window of the minivan. You can imagine how scary that was for the kids in the van, as well as for the adults. And most of the cyclists that were there were also expressing shock and horror that somebody would actually throw their bike through the back window of the minivan. Now, I heard about this story through emails that I received from several of you listeners, and I read all of the news articles, and I looked at all of the videos online, and I've put links to many of those in the show notes, and I encourage you to go there to see for yourself what's going on. And as a result, I contacted fellow podcaster John Winston, who does the Bikescape podcast, which is a very popular bike culture podcast that comes to us from San Francisco. And so you'll hear my interview with John, and it's an extended interview at the end of the show, because I wanted to find out the cyclist side of the story. And what I appreciated from John's perspective was that, as far as he's concerned, there are certainly two wrongs here. If the mom did indeed hit the cyclist and ran away, well, then she certainly did something wrong. There's no doubt about that. I've been the victim myself of a hit and run, and I know how wrong that is. We all know how wrong that is. On the other hand, John also said that an act of vandalism, like throwing your bike through the back of a window, is no way to solve a problem. And we have all had altercations with motorists out there on the roads. I had one today. Literally, a kid driving an extremely expensive brand new Mercedes flipped a U-turn right in front of me as I was coming down a hill, and I literally screeched on the brakes. And had I not seen him, had I not hit the brakes, I would have slammed into the side of his car and very likely could have been extremely injured. We've all had incidents like that before. I didn't pick up my bike and throw it through the back of this guy's window. I didn't accost him in any way. I continued to ride because nothing good would have come out of arguing with the motorist. Nothing good would have come out, certainly, of vandalizing the motorist's vehicle. So John came down on that side as well. It's an interesting interview, and I hope that you'll stick around to listen to it, because I think that we can all learn something from this incident, whether we participate in critical mass, whether we agree with critical mass. It's an incident that has to do with cyclists and with motorists. And quite frankly, this incident bothers me, if for no other reason than the fact that whoever threw that bike through the window and whoever else was acting inappropriately that day, it's bad for cyclists, because in the end, from what I've seen from the publicity, it's the cyclists that are coming out as looking like the bad guys, and none of us need that. Now, speaking of incidents that give cyclists a bad name, and specifically in this case, cycling competitors a bad name, you all recall the Operation Puerto scandal that occurred in Spain last year that took some of the main contenders from the 2006 Tour de France out of competition and out of contention for the race. And in the case of, for instance, German rider Jan Ulrich, seems to have forced his retirement from professional cycling. Well, now there's new news in the Jan Ulrich and Operation Puerto cases, specifically the fact that a DNA sample that was taken from Jan Ulrich has now been matched to blood bags that were seized in the Puerto affair. Now, according to German prosecutors, quote, "We found 9 blood samples that we were able to compare with the blood samples from Jan Ulrich." Quote, "We were able to establish the identity of Ulrich." Now, according to Jan, for his part, he said on his website that it's quite possible that the reports were manipulated and designed to destroy his reputation. Ulrich said, quote, "I have a clear conscience, and the latest events and reports haven't changed that a bit. In my whole career, I have never lied or used anyone, and I can't admit to a mistake when there is no mistake." Also, German authorities are now considering filing charges against Ulrich, and they say that there's a good possibility that if charges are to be filed, they will be filed by the end of this year. According to prosecutors, even if they do file the charges by year's end, it could take up to 2 years to prosecute. Just for your information, fraud convictions in Germany can range from just a simple fine up to a 10-year prison sentence. I know that there's going to be a lot more that we'll hear about this case in the weeks, months, and years to come, but one of the things that I think it reminds me of is a little bit of the Floyd Landis case, simply because here is Jan being tried in the media at the very, very beginning, the nexus of this entire investigation against him. And so it's a bit unfair for him and a bit difficult for him to defend himself at this point, but perhaps he'll take Well, maybe he'll take a page from the Floyd Landis playbook and go on the offensive in his defense, just as Floyd has done. And one of the reasons why more and more I'm hearing people say that they think that Floyd might actually get off on these charges, because the evidence that Floyd is presenting seems to indicate that there was a lot that went wrong in his case, and it could very well lead to the dismissal of his case. We'll see what happens come May 14th.
I would rather be racing my bicycle if difficult, but the system needs to be changed, and we're trying to educate people through the website also about what needs to be done to make the system more balanced.
And speaking of the Floyd Landis defense, what you're listening to is the audio portion of a 7-minute video that's been posted up on YouTube by the Floyd Fairness Fund and those involved in Floyd Landis's defense. It goes into a lot of the details about Floyd's case, and it's just another way that Floyd Landis has decided that he's going to fight the charges against him for doping during the 2006 Tour de France. If you'd like to take a look at it yourself, go to the website at www.thefredcast.com and click on the show notes link. Tonight's show is show number 67, and it will give you a link directly to the YouTube video so that you can continue to judge for yourself.
Degraded sample, a contaminated sample that they went ahead and tested. I think the facts of the science bear the proof of Floyd's innocence.
One, two, three. Yeah. No eyes are closed.
You go out and ride on a bike with him and you see a guy who is funny.
And if that wasn't enough news about racers and doping and potential doping and drug scandals, last Wednesday the UCI announced, and this was a day after the German prosecutors announced the information about Jan Ullrich's blood having been found in the Puerto samples, the UCI announced that all 20 Pro Tour teams and all but a couple of the Pro Tour riders have now agreed to make DNA samples available for testing in future doping disputes. According to the UCI's president, Pat McQuaid, the commitment of riders and teams, quote, gives us an important tool to work with. Now, realize that this doesn't mean that the riders immediately have to give DNA samples by a particular date to the UCI or to WADA or any other anti-doping authorities. All it means is that the riders and the teams have given a binding commitment that should they be involved in a doping dispute, they must then give a DNA sample so that they would be able to have then conclusive proof about whether or not the sample that was being tested was indeed linked to that particular rider. Now, as I mentioned, there are a handful of riders who have not agreed to sign this binding agreement and who have said, no, we do not agree that we'll be giving our DNA samples in such a situation. Those riders are not being named, nor are they subject, at least at this point, to any official sanction. However, the commitment does show that the UCI and the Pro Tour teams and the riders are serious about their anti-doping efforts. Most significantly, however, I think that this is a step in the right direction to having better controls and better policies and better procedures to make sure that we don't end up in a situation like we've seen in the past, like the Floyd Landis case, for instance, where it does appear that somebody doped, but we're not entirely sure that the individual who has been accused of doping is indeed the individual whose sample was tested. And so this is just one step in the right direction to making sure that the proper controls are in place so that mistakes are less likely to happen in the future. Well, enough about doping and enough about scandals. It's time to talk a little bit of racing. And April 8th marked the Tour of Flanders, which is Belgium's biggest cycling race and is literally a cycling classic. When we last met here on the Fredcast, we were talking about the fact that Tom Bonin looked very good and looked like the real favorite to win the race. At the end of the day, however, unfortunately, Tom Bonin was nowhere near the top of the ranks. Unfortunately, Tom Bonin was involved in a crash early in the race and he hurt both of his knees. And so he wasn't there at the finish line when Alessandro Bayon of Italy won this year's Tour of Flanders in a sprint at the finish, beating Leif Host of Belgium. Now, both riders had broken away about 10 miles left in the race, and they held off the chasers, and Luca Paolini ended up being in third place, barely beating out Karsten Kroon of the Netherlands and Vladimir Gusev of Russia. Now, there's a lot of great racing coming up as the racing season really hits its stride here over the next couple of weeks. And the race that's ongoing right now, in fact, it started today, April the 9th, is the Vuelta Ciclista al País Vasco, also known to most people who don't speak Spanish as the Tour of the Basque Country. Again, the first stage of this year's race began today, and it was won by Spanish rider Juan José Cobo of the Saunier Duval Prodeer squad. And now, he finished first after a 139-kilometer stage around the mountains of, and again, this is one of those words I'm going to mispronounce, Urrexu. Oh, I can't do that. It's Urrexu. And he won the race in 3 hours, 43 minutes, and 5 seconds. Second place went to Costa Parnier rider Constantin Zabaya of Spain, and third, Oscar Sevilla, also of Spain. Zabaya was 10 seconds behind the first place finisher Cobo, and Sevilla was 1 second behind Zabaya. Now, last year's champion, last year's winner of this race was Jose Angel Gomez Marchante, and he ended up finishing in fourth place today. There's plenty of time for him to make his move and repeat this year if he'd like, because the Vuelta Ciclista al País Vasco continues from April 9th through the 14th, so we'll have results for you on the next Fredcast to let you know who actually is the champion of the 2007 Tour of the Basque Country. There are two more excellent races coming up. The first one is this Wednesday, April the 11th. It's the Gent-Wevelgem, also known as the Sprinters Classic. This one should be an excellent race. And if you're not familiar with this particular race, it is mostly flat, hence the reason why it's sort of a sprinter's race. There are a couple of climbs and some cobble sections which are there to challenge the rider. And in 2006, the winner was Norway's Tor Husovd. So he'll, of course, be looking to repeat, but of course, I think Alessandro Petacchi would also like a piece of the action because he was just edged out last year by Husovd. And that, of course, takes place on April the 11th. And with the cobbles section, it's an excellent prelude to April 15th's Hell of the North. Again, it's Paris-Roubaix. 260 kilometers of tough sections, including the famous pavés with those very tricky, very dangerous cobbles. Of course, last year this race was won by Fabian Cancellara, but I think there's a lot of other riders who have their eye on this prize, including George Hincapie from the United States. Unfortunately, George's crash at this year's Amgen Tour of California is going to keep him out of these spring classics, and we're not going to get to see him possibly until the Tour of Georgia. So this year's Paris-Roubaix, as every year, will be exciting. This is one of those ones that I love the TV coverage, and it's one that you like to watch wall to wall. So tune in to cycling.tv for their live coverage or same-day coverage on April 15th on Versus here in the United States. This is a great race and one you do not want to miss. Several weeks ago here on the Fredcast, I was doing daily coverage from the Amgen Tour of California and marveling at the crowds out on the course and at the enthusiasm for cycling that we saw here in California. So it was a bit surprising to me to receive a press release from the organizers of the Tour of Utah, saying that this year's Tour of Utah was being postponed, and there seemed to be hints at cancellation as well. Now, reading from the press release, quote, "While enthusiasm and support for the Tour of Utah continues to be high, after several months of aggressive sales and marketing efforts, the management team was unable to secure the required level of sponsorship support needed to produce the multi-stage race they had planned. Based on initial feedback from potential sponsors, the race organizers believe that postponing the race will allow the time necessary to secure sufficient sponsor support to produce the race." Now, quite honestly, this has me just a little bit bothered, because here's the Tour of Utah postponing, possibly canceling, we don't know yet, their race. And there's the Tour of Georgia, formerly the Ford Tour of Georgia, getting ready to start up in just a couple of days, and they too do not have a title sponsor. So it has me just a little bit concerned as we bring more and more stage racing to the United States. Are we running into what could be a sponsorship problem? It would seem to me that based on the Tour of California and the obvious success that we saw here, that it should be much easier to get sponsors, but it just shows that American cycling still has a ways to go to convince some of these major corporations to get involved, which is quite obvious, at least to me, quite obviously a very popular sport. We just need to let people know how popular it is. And then hopefully these races won't be left with the sponsorship troubles that they seem to be having today. Let's hope that all of this turns around very quickly for cycling athletes and for cycling fans. Now, despite their sponsorship troubles, the Tour of Georgia is going on as planned, as I mentioned recently on the Fredcast as well. For those of you that are in the southeastern portion of the United States or have the time or inclination to get yourselves there, the Tour de Georgia is April 16th through the 22nd, 2007. There's a link in the show notes, but the website is tourdegeorgia.com. Unfortunately, I am not going to be able to make it to this year's Tour of Georgia to give you the same kind of coverage that I was able to give you from the Tour of California, because that's the weekend that I'll be participating in the 2007 version of the Ride Across California. And if you weren't listening previously, that's the ride that's just for fifth graders and their parents. And on Sunday of this week, we'll be dipping our rear wheels in the Colorado River at the Arizona-Colorado-Mexico border, and we'll be riding westward across the state of California, and we won't be stopping until we hit the Pacific Ocean in Carlsbad, where we'll dip the front wheels of our bikes into the ocean. And I think it's going to be a great opportunity for all those fifth graders, my Emily in particular, to accomplish that amazing athletic feat and finish what they started, achieving the goal of riding across the state of California. I have to tell you, for a 10-year-old, that is a huge feat. So I won't be at the Tour of Georgia. I'll be riding across California. If you listen to my other cycling-related podcast, The Spokesman, at www.the-spokesman.com, sorry about that, us podcasters have to get those plugs in when we can, then you know that we had a recent special guest on the show, and that was John Moss from the bikeportland.org blog and website. And John, quote unquote, broke the news on The Spokesman last Monday morning, letting us know that Nike and Trek were going to be severing their partnership for cycling come December 31st. 2007. Now, according to the Oregonian newspaper, quote, Nike said Tuesday that it plans to drop most of its cycling apparel and footwear line for consumers as the company narrows its focus to outfitting cycling teams and Nike-endorsed athletes. They went on to say that Nike's seven-year relationship with Trek, which produces clothing and shoes for cyclists under the shoe company's brand, will not be renewed after it ends this year, Nike spokesman Derek Kent said. Now, of course, Nike's seven-year relationship with Trek is not their first foray into the cycling world. As a matter of fact, I remember way back in the early 90s when I was working for a company that was heavily sponsoring and supporting John Tomac, the world champion mountain biker. And Johnny had a deal to wear Nike clothing on the mountain bike circuit as well. Despite that, I believe that the cooperation that they had with Trek during the Lance Armstrong years was probably the most successful for them. It's a bit dismaying to hear that they're going to be, at least according to the Oregonian, getting out of the cycling-specific business. I guess they've just had a little bit too much competition from more well-known and well-established cycling shoe companies that have been around for much longer periods of time. So it's a bit sad to see them getting out of that portion of the business, but, you know, they're Nike. I think they'll survive. Now, if you're like me, you have probably bought or sold a couple of items here and there on eBay, and perhaps if you're like my mom, you've sold hundreds, if not thousands, of items on eBay. Well, Apparently, eBay is really becoming a real problem for the cycling industry. As a matter of fact, I recall recently I was in a local bike shop and a gentleman came in with a bike in a box, and the store manager asked him where he had gotten the bike. And when he said that he had gotten it from eBay, the manager became extremely reluctant to help build that bike for the gentleman who brought it in and who bought it on eBay. And when I spoke with the manager about that after the gentleman walked away for a short time, the manager explained to me that there are a lot of problems on eBay with bikes being misrepresented as being new or barely used, and instead they've actually been involved in crashes and can be quite dangerous. There are a lot of gray market and products that are showing up on some of these bikes, and there are a lot of counterfeit products showing up on these bikes. And that was the first time I'd heard about counterfeit cycling products showing up on eBay. So then I noticed a press release and a page on the Zip website. That's Z-I-P-P, or for those of you not in the United States, that could be Z-I-P-P. And this is what they had to say on their website. "We have recently become aware, thanks to a proactive consumer, of fake and counterfeit SLC2 handlebars entering the market and being sold on eBay. New product that finds its way onto eBay should be treated with extreme caution, is not covered under the Zip warranty, and is subject to potential catastrophic failure. As these bars are less than our normal weight, and they are being made and sold outside of our control, we wish to alert all potential buyers to the danger that these counterfeit bars could pose." And they go on to explain what the differences are between authentic Zip handlebars and the counterfeit Zip handlebars. The bottom line here is, as it should be anytime you're buying something sight unseen, just looking at it on eBay, caveat emptor, buyer beware. Make sure that what you're buying is coming from a reputable party, and make sure that what you're buying is in fact what is being representative. Just be careful when you buy something on eBay, especially something like a handlebar. When they say catastrophic failure, I see bloody people lying on the sidewalk, and that is not where I want any of you to be. So please be careful when you buy stuff on eBay. This is just another public service announcement from your friendly Fredcast. And finally, for this week's show, speaking of public service announcements, I wanted to mention an article that appeared in this week's Los Angeles Times. This time, once again, they're tackling a subject which they seem to go to maybe whenever they need to fill space, or perhaps whenever they've done just a little bit more research. And this is the subject of cycling saddles and male sensitivity. It is a really well-researched article with a lot of very good information, and it's one that I recommend that you take a look at. I think that it was probably written a little bit more for your average layperson or non-high-end cyclist or cycling consumer, but I think that there's a lot of good information in there that you should all consider when it comes to choosing your bicycle seat. And of course, I've put a link in the show notes so that you can check it out. And the show notes are always available at www.thefredcast.com. Go check that article out. I think there's some information in there you might want to know. Having covered that sensitive subject, I think it's time to end the news for this week's show. Well, as I mentioned at the top of the news tonight, there was an incident last week at the Critical Mass Ride in San Francisco, California, where allegedly a minivan was being driven recklessly by a mom with her kids and her husband in the car, and they allegedly hit a cyclist, causing him to fall to the ground, running over his bike, and then running from the scene of the accident. They were then chased by some of the cyclists who were part of the Critical Mass Ride. The cyclists stopped the vehicle and attempted to hold them for the police, and that's when things got a little bit ugly, or a lot bit ugly, and a bicycle was thrown through the rear window of the minivan. When I first read about this, I was extremely dismayed and very concerned about what effect it might have on the way that cyclists are viewed by the general public and by motorists. And I also wanted to get a little bit more information on what had happened, because as we all know, there are always two sides to every story. And when I first read the story, I was extremely angry that somebody would get so upset at a situation like this, that they would terrorize small children in a car, that they would vandalize a vehicle, and put people at such risk. And so I wanted to speak with somebody who I knew would have the full story. And so I went to our go-to guy in San Francisco, and that's John Winston, the host of the Bikescape podcast. And here is the extended interview that I had with John Winston yesterday afternoon. I'm talking to John Winston from the Bikescape podcast, available at bikescape.blogspot.com and, of course, iTunes and pretty much everywhere else podcasts are sold. Hey, John, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on my show.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
I'm a Fred, too.
See, it doesn't matter where you're from. Everybody relates to being a Fred.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about critical mass, specifically about an incident that occurred recently in San Francisco. But let's start first with something that, you know, we sort of take for granted because we know about critical mass. But if you wouldn't mind, give me a quick history, a quick explanation. What is critical mass? Where has it been? Where is it going?
Well, critical mass started here in San Francisco back in, I believe it was 1992, 15 years ago. And it was basically people at that time, there were no bike lanes in San Francisco, and it was a pretty unhappy place to try and ride a bicycle. So a few people who rode together, some of them messengers, some of them not, decided to ride home from work together. They thought maybe riding in a group together would be good. And they called it the commute clot, and they set it up for the last Friday of every month and started out with about 30 people. And after a while, some time went by, it got more popular. Some people were watching a movie about bicycling in China, a movie by Ted White called The Return of the Scorcher. Excellent movie. And the narrator talked about how they had no traffic lights in China. And, a group of hundreds of bicyclists would come to an intersection and they'd stop because it'd be cross traffic of cars and bikes. And one person would poke out and the cars would stop, the cross traffic would stop, then everybody would go through. And the narrator said that when that happened, people had attained critical mass and then they would move through. And somebody said, oh, that's a good name for critical mass. And it's grown over the years. It's had its ups and downs. Basically, what it does is it sort of accidentally we arrived at this understanding that what it does is it changes the space on the roadway. It takes what used to be a big river of steel and concrete and turns it into a party. And it pointed out all sorts of ideas about how we can use our public space, and that it doesn't have to be dominated by cars. And it's not an anti-car movement, but it does make people question, what do we do with our public space and how do we use it and how can we make our cities more livable? And over the years, new generations have come in. It's been years, and a lot of people who are riding critical mass were just barely born at the time it started. And, you know, there's always the misconception that we're there to block traffic and that we're there to cause trouble and to fight against drivers and that we hate cars and we hate drivers. And I don't think that was the original intent, and I still don't think it is for 99% of the people who ride. But there is always this internal conversation in critical mass about that. And we try to police ourselves when bad things happen, and we try and encourage good things, with route maps and themes for the ride and things like that. But there's no leadership, and there's no way that you can just oust somebody if you don't like them. The only thing we can do is get together as a group and talk about it and hopefully get people to raise their voices when they see something they don't like. But it's been an interesting ride, and everybody's learned a lot over the last 15 years about bicycling on the road, and it's brought together a great community of people, and we've actually been able to change things a lot for the better. Even when bad things happen, as P.T. Barnum said, any publicity is good publicity. And when we raise our profile in the city streets, we actually have found that we've been able to make a lot of headway in the small things, the small incremental things, adding a bike lane here or a bike rack there. So it's been overall pretty beneficial for the city.
And one of the things that you mentioned, of course, is that there is no leadership. It's more of a movement. There's nobody in charge of it. Nobody plans it. Everybody shows up. They know where and when. And it's just a mass movement of concerned cyclists. And then, of course, you mentioned there can be a few bad apples. And I remember you did a show on your podcast a few months ago where you sat around with some other concerned folks to talk about critical mass. And you mentioned the fact that there can be trouble, there can be troublemakers, and that you do everything you can to self-police and to keep everything organized and well, just sort of a well-oiled machine rolling down the street. Is that right?
That's the idea. Yeah. It's difficult to police people, you know, when there is no leadership, mm-hmm. and we prefer it that way. I mean, it's basically the only thing that you're sure about with critical mass is that everybody's going to show up at 6 o'clock at Justin Herman Plaza on the last Friday of the month. But just because there's no leadership doesn't mean we don't have responsibility for our own actions. And we have responsibility for the actions of those around us. And it's incumbent on all of us. This is my opinion. And everybody has a different opinion at critical mass. But my opinion is it's incumbent on all of us to call out people when behavior gets bad and to discuss the polemics of critical mass with people on the ride. And the whole thing about the ride is about talking and creating community. So, sure. I mean, that's my opinion.
What are some of the positive changes that you've seen in the city of San Francisco as a result of critical mass?
Well, when critical mass got really big back in 97, that was when we started having rides of over, you know, 5,000 people. And even some rides, some of the bigger rides in the summer would reach 8,000 or 9,000 people. It was huge. And we're starting to head that way again this year, it seems like. So we have to be ready for the kind of problems we had back then. But
what were some of the problems? What were some of the problems? Because
when you have 8,000 people on the street, you know, traffic's going to get tied up.
Sure.
You know, there's always a lot of causes for traffic jams. There's the ballpark getting out, you know, after a game, and right. everybody's riding together in their cars, and there's a traffic jam, or there's, you know, rush hour. There's always a critical mass of cars, but when there's a critical mass of bikes, it draws lines in the sand, and it. What happened in 97 was, it's a long story, but the mayor was caught in his limousine, and he decided there will be no more critical mass. Hmm. And when that happened, of course, there was a big critical mass as a result, and that caused all sorts of friction. But as a result, the Bicycle Coalition suddenly blossomed from 500 members to 2,000 members, and now they're up to almost 7,000 members. Hmm. And I believe that critical mass, being sort of the IRA to the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition, Sinn Féin, kind of mobilized people. I don't know if that's a good comment, a good way to describe it, but it kind of mobilized people. And in the interim, we've come up with a new bike plan, and we have a bike friendly bicycle Board of Supervisors, which is our city council. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, the city has come a long way. I think Bicycling Magazine rates us as one of the number one cities, or somewhere in the top five for bicycling. And it is a great place to ride now. And drivers have been educated, and bicyclists have also been educated. You don't see bicyclists hugging the curb anymore. They actually ride in the lane. You don't hear about doorings anymore. Mm-hmm. And not too much anymore. And, you know, things have come a long way, and I give a lot of that credit to the hard work of the SFBC, but also to the community building of critical mass. I think the two things work together very well.
So that's great. So yeah, you had some problems early on, but you've sort of gotten beyond those, and you've mm-hmm. seen some positive changes. And then all of a sudden, these articles hit last week, and of course, a listener alerted me to this one that was in the SF Gate by these columnists, Mateer and Ross, which was not real positive when it came to cyclists. Yeah. And just looking at it real quickly, you know, it says that here was a woman, her husband, their two children, and three preteens. They'd come to San Francisco from Redwood City. They were celebrating the birthday of one of the kids, an 11-year-old daughter. And in the words of the columnist, quote, "Things took a turn for the worse at about 9 p.m. when the family was leaving Japantown, just as the party of about 3,000 bikers was winding down its monthly red lights to be damned ride through the city. Suddenly, Ferrando said her car was surrounded by hundreds of cyclists. Not being from San Francisco, she thought she might have inadvertently crossed paths with a bicycle race and couldn't figure out why the police, who she had just passed, hadn't warned her. Confusion, however, quickly turned to terror, she said, when the swarming cyclists began wildly circling around and then running into the sides of her Toyota van. Later on, it says that one of the cyclists threw their bike through the rear window of her car, and they were pounding on her car, and they were climbing on her car. You got to know what happened. Tell me what happened to cause all of this problem here for Ferrando and her kids.
Well, when I first read that article, I knew something was up. But, of course, you know, I've seen incidents happen, and everybody has, and anybody in critical mass who read that article that first day was shocked and dismayed, and anybody who hadn't been actually in that incident, and everybody was very sorry for what happened, and the poor kids that were in the car, all of that was just terrible. But then as time went by, some of the facts started coming out. Those of us who are on the listservs and read the blogs and everything, we started hearing more about the story. And my friend Jim has actually compiled a whole list of bullet points. And basically one thing was that it didn't really happen at critical mass. It happened hours after the main riot had split up. It was 9 o'clock already.
You know, that's interesting. I looked at all of the news stories and I looked at, we talked about this earlier, and all the videos that are online, and nobody mentions that.
Yeah, no, and there were not 3,000 cyclists. There were maybe tops 30. There were 25 to 30 cyclists. They had split off, and it was in Japantown, I believe. And they were beginning. People had started. I had left the ride. The ride was actually a very nice ride. We went out to some neighborhoods we'd never been to before, and it was beautiful. And things went pretty smoothly through the most of the ride. And I had split off when we got back downtown to the ballpark and went to a birthday party, and it was an hour later that this happened out in Japantown. So, and the Chronicle also said that the motorist inched into the bicyclist, and they said they tapped the back wheel of the bicyclist. And the eyewitnesses report that the car was actually speeding into the crowd, swerving, laying on the horn. The word tapped actually got changed three times in the article during the day on the web, changed to allegedly bumped and then inadvertently tapped again. But actually, the person who was hit by the car was actually thrown off his bike, and the bicycle was run over by the car. The bicycle was hurt. The bicyclist was hurt, but he refused an ambulance because it would have happened at his own cost, I assume.
Now, quoting the Gate again, and I have to find it again, but according to the Gate, because I'm guessing that Matera and Ross aren't incredibly bicycle friendly, but one of the things that they said, and I've got to find it, but it basically says that when the police tried to get a report from the cyclist who was, in their words, allegedly a victim, he said, quote, he wasn't hurt. He also refused to give his name or any other information. Then, after a few swear words, the alleged victim took off on his bike while the rest of the crowd continued to yell at both the cops and the van.
So now I'm able to.
Pardon me?
Go ahead. I actually haven't been able to get in touch with the person who was on the bicycle who was hurt, but a person I know, Kate McCarthy, was there, and she was a witness. She said that the bicycle did get run over. I don't think he was able to ride away on it, but he didn't want to talk to the press. He doesn't want to talk to anybody.
Now, does Kate know the victim?
I don't know.
Okay, because I'd be curious to know, you know, if he's injured at all. Now, let's sort of break
Everybody's
this down.
Everybody's curious about that.
Yeah, let's break this down for a second, because and as I told you when we first started talking, my initial impression when I heard all of this was, are you kidding me? I mean, as we've talked, I was the victim of a hit and run in my car a couple of months ago, and I know what the adrenaline can be like, and I understand how really angry you can get, but I think you and I totally agree. There was no excuse for throwing a bike through the back of a minivan.
Well, the motorist attempted to flee the scene.
Right.
That's why the bicyclist blocked her way.
Right.
She went ahead of maybe about a block or so, and other bicyclists stopped her, and they were just basically standing in front of the car.
Mm-hmm.
One bicyclist did, at that point, break the motorist's back window, and then he fled the scene. So one out of the 30 people that were there did something totally egregious, and this is probably the only thing that's really happened that was bad on the part of the cyclist. But I don't think any of the cyclists knew there were children in the vehicle, because it had tinted windows apparently.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of video of the woman who was driving the van, and video of her van. You know, it's a typical family minivan, and they all come with tinted windows these days. So I think that's probably true. Yeah, and it was 9 o'clock at night, so I can understand that they had no idea who was in the car.
Well, I guess. So the Chronicle says that the motorist had the presence of mind, quote, to call 911 on her phone. And maybe she did. She probably did. But it was also a bicyclist who called first to report a hit and run.
Mm-hmm.
And the police have a record of that as well. The police arrived. They immediately started threatening the bicyclist. And the sergeant in charge made a false accusation of drunkenness against the bicyclist who called 911. She came up with her cell phone and said, thank God you're here.
Right.
This person's a hit and run. And he told her to sit down on the ground. You're drunk. And he refused to take her statement, and also refused to take the statement of the person who was hit by the car, the person on the bicycle, because he said he falsely told him that you can't give a statement unless you call an ambulance. You have to be really badly injured in order to make a statement, which is untrue. And that's an issue that we have to address with the police, because that's something that's been coming up on and off over the years where the police refused to take statements in other kinds of accidents between cars and bikes. But that's something that we're going to have to address again, I guess, because the police chief has already said that everybody is entitled to a police report.
You know, it sounds to me like overall the police handled this thing incorrectly from the very beginning. If I understand the reports correctly, the police actually waved the minivan through the intersection. Had they not waved the minivan through the intersection, nothing would have ever happened. So there was that incident, which could have potentially led to the hit and run. And then, of course, the fact that they weren't taking the statements of the cyclists at the scene, because, I mean, no matter what your feeling is about critical mass or no matter what your feeling is about the cyclists, if you're a police officer, it's your duty, I would think, to take both sides and to find out the stories from everybody involved to figure out where the truth is, because there's always two sides to every story, and somewhere in the middle you're going to find the truth, I think.
Exactly. It's also the responsibility of reporters to take two sides of the story.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm guessing that Matera and Ross and some of these others haven't done that. But I did notice that one of the things that the mayor called for was for the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition to issue a statement of their own condemning what happened, and specifically condemning the cyclist. And again, you know, as we talked before we got on the air here, I said, let's take both sides at their word. Let's take the word of the cyclists who say that the motorist hit somebody on a bike, ran over their bike, and then ran. And then let's take the motorists for their word, saying that the cyclists, some of them, a small bunch of them, took their anger out on the car and on the people inside the car and, you know, sort of terrorize them. Well, really, I think the intention of the main group was probably just, as you said, to hold them until the police showed up to take a report. Finally, the San Francisco and I don't mean, you know, that it was delayed. When I say the word finally, it's just on April 4th, they issued what they called a media alert. And it said that that they're condemning both sides. They condemn the motorist for what the motorist did, and they condemn those who vandalized the car for what they did. What do you think about that?
Well, I think any kind of violence on the street is abysmal. You don't want to run people over on purpose. That's assault. And you don't want to any kind of violence from any quarter on the street is totally unacceptable.
Right.
And I agree with the Bike Coalition about that. And they also had to make clear that they don't control critical mass in any way.
Of course.
A lot of people have the misconception that the Bicycle Coalition is critical mass in the city, but they're not. You know, the critical mass really does not have any leaders. A lot of people have trouble understanding that because, you know, it's been so successful over the years. But
what do we learn from this, and where do we go? Because, of course, I think that as you said, some of the reporters haven't taken both sides of the story, and there is a lot of anger out there. Mm-hmm. Where do we go from here?
Well, it's good to get the story does come out. You know, as they say, a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth gets its pants on. And, you know, this is only a half truth what we read in the newspaper. And the news is getting out. And one has to also look at the political backdrop of what's going on right now with the newspaper being again tomorrow at I don't know when this podcast is going up, but 1 o'clock Monday, there's going to be a meeting at City Hall to a hearing about closing the Golden Gate Park to car traffic on Saturdays, a 1.5 mile stretch of JFK Drive. And the Chronicle has come out against it. And I believe, you know, the Matera and Ross is a political column. It's a political gossip column. It's not really, they're not really reporters. They report gossip about, you know, who's going out with who at City Hall and that kind of stuff. And it's, although I really can't say for sure, I really do believe that there is a connection between the hearing tomorrow and an effort to demonize bicyclists in the city. And Phil Matera actually did call Leah Shaham at the Bike Coalition before Critical Mass and asked, you know, trying to dig up dirt. He said, what kind of disruption is going to happen tonight at Critical Mass, is what he asked her. And Leah said, well, of course, I don't know. And of course, we don't organize critical mass. And so I have no idea. And if there was anything that was going to happen, I don't think I'd be able to influence it. And he did not accept that for an answer. He went on for 5 minutes with her on the phone. And so it did look like they were trying to dig something up before anything even happened. And I really think that the political backdrop, it's really important to see what's happening in bicycle car politics in the city, and they're trying. There hasn't been any conflict between bicyclists and cars in a while, in a good 10 years, since the last time Critical Mass had problems with. And I think that newspapers thrive on conflict anyway, and when they can build this kind of conflict up to further their own political ends, I think it's kind of scary. But I do think that's what's happening.
Well, hopefully we'll see critical masses in the future with where we don't have these issues. And of course, I talk about all the time on my show. I mean, I ride here in Los Angeles, and I've told the story time after time, and listeners are probably tired of hearing me say it. You know, I come home after a training ride every night. My wife and kids say, well, how many people tried to kill you today? Because it's dangerous out there for bikes. And so whether it's a critical mass or whether it's just one cyclist out on an evening training ride, it can be very dangerous. And we've all had close calls. And unfortunately, in this case, it sounds like there's a good chance that somebody had more than a close call with the car. And so whether it's, like I said, whether it's critical mass or just one person on a bike, what we need to do is we need to educate everyone who uses the roads about what's safe and proper, and to pay attention to every road user, whether they're in a mega SUV or they're on a single speed bike. It really doesn't matter. Everybody has the right to be there. And of course, everybody has the right not to get injured when they're out there using the roads. And so the most important thing that hopefully will come from all of this is more awareness that everybody has to share the road. And hopefully, it sounds like there's going to be an even greater effort, perhaps on the part of those who are involved in critical mass, to make sure that the self-policing does happen. Because I think that publicity like this, although you're right, any publicity can be good publicity, this is not the kind of publicity you really want.
Well, when the facts come out, I think things will shake out. And I would like to urge anybody who rides in critical mass who is outraged by what happened, for whatever reason, don't stop coming to critical mass. It's not going to get better if you don't show up. I think participation is everything, and it's not something you go to see. It's something you go to do. And if you feel strongly one way or the other about this at critical mass, you should go and try and use your influence to make it a better ride.
There you go. John, thank you so much for being on the show. Tell everybody once again where they can find your podcast.
It's at bikescape.blogspot.com.
And of course,
on iTunes and everywhere else.
There you go, and on iTunes as well. Great, John. Thanks so much for spending the time today. And good luck with all of your efforts up in San Francisco.
All right. Well, thank you.
Sure. My pleasure.
Pleasure being on your show.
So that was John Winston from the Bikescape podcast. And again, that's available at bikescape.blogspot.com. And of course, I've got a link in the show notes to the website, as well as to where you can find Bikescape on iTunes. Well, that is going to do it for the show for this week, but a couple of notes that I wanted to make before we go, and that is, number one, don't forget the Fredcast socks are now available, and you can find those online at www.thefredcast.com. Plus, in case you haven't noticed, I have posted 3 Fredcast extras, each with individual speeches from this year's 2007 National Bike Summit in Washington, D.C. There's Louisville Mayor's Jerry Abramson, Trex President John Burke, and now Saris Cycling Group's President Chris Fortune and his special guest Floyd Landis. Hopefully you'll give a listen to each of those. I think they're all very interesting, each in their own way. And I should have at least one more special podcast from this year's National Bike Summit. So watch for that coming soon. Also, if you'd like to send me some email, please do so. The email address is thefredcast@gmail.com. Audio comments can be sent via email or to our listener hotline at area code 206-203-FRED. Don't forget to visit our website at www.thefredcast.com. And in case you haven't noticed, like a lot of other podcasters, I have also gotten the Twitter bug, and I've started to post my Twitter comments, and you can find those on the website at www.thefredcast.com, or you can go to twitter.com/ Fredcast to see what I'm doing at any given moment of the day. It's a little bit weird, but I'm having a lot of fun with it. So please go ahead and check it out. And finally, the last thing I want to mention, and something I haven't mentioned in a while, and that is please go to Podcast Alley and vote for the Fredcast there. It's always a great way to make sure that our audience continues to grow. Help us spread the word, tell three friends, or go onto iTunes and post a review. I really would appreciate it very much. As we do every week, the end of the show includes our PodSafe cycling music, and that music comes to us every week from the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. This week's music actually came to me in an email from the band themselves asking if I'd like to play their music on the show. They have some great music, and I agreed without any fight at all because I think that their music is really good. The band is called The National Pool. This week's song is called AO1, and there are lots of links in the show notes to where you can find The National Pool on iTunes, on Podshow, and on their MySpace page, their own website. So that's going to do it for tonight's show. Thanks again for listening. Thanks for staying subscribed. Stay tuned for our next show coming up very, very soon. In the meantime, enjoy the music. But most of all, enjoy the ride.